Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
These policies most acutely are going to diminish the well-being of LGBTQ plus youth, but they're going to have a harmful effect on the entire school community.
The Mat-Su School Board prepares to vote on a pair of policies that would impact transgender students and sex ed. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, scientists investigate how the highly pathogenic bird flu withstood the winter in Alaska.
Since late 2021, we've had roughly 3,000 detections in wild birds in the United States. So this is like nothing we've ever seen.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience. Your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The Matanuska Susitna Borough School Board is preparing to vote tomorrow on a pair of policies that would impact transgender students. The policies are nearly identical to a bill Governor Mike Dunleavy introduced during the legislative session. The policies would require parents to provide written permission for a student to use a different name or pronoun at school. They would also require parents to opt their students into sex ed classes rather than opting out. And the policies would require the school board to approve curriculum that mentions any sexual topic. Rose O'Hara Jolly is the state director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. She spoke at the May meeting when the policies were introduced.
These changes are an outright extreme attack on LGBTQ youth that forcibly outs and misgenders LGBTQ students, implements don't be gay policies, and attacks sex ed for all Alaskans.
The Mat-Su was the first and only district in the state to pass policies that prevent transgender students from participating in sports and using restrooms that match their gender identity. The policies were recommended by a 3-member committee of the school board. None of the committee members responded to repeated requests for comment. Alaskans spoke out overwhelmingly against Dunleavy's bill during public testimony this spring. It didn't pass. American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska Policy Director Mike Garvey says the policies would be harmful.
These policies most acutely are going to diminish the well-being of LGBTQ plus youth, but they're going to have a harmful effect on the entire school community.
The Alaska Safe Children's Act went into effect in 2017 and requires districts to provide age-appropriate sexual abuse and assault prevention training, as well as teen dating violence awareness training. The law requires parental notification and allows parents to remove their students from the lessons. The board is scheduled to vote on the two policies at their meeting tomorrow. Biologists have announced this year's first casualty of a wild bird to avian influenza. It happened last month, and as Emily Schwing reports for KYUK, the announcement comes after a frenzied year of tracking the virus among wild birds across the state.
Avian influenza first appeared in Alaska last year, and it was rough. The virus claimed the life of a brown bear cub at a state recreation site on Kodiak. A second brown bear cub in southeast Alaska was also infected. Last year, the virus killed more than 1,000 domestic poultry in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley, and it slowed shipments of eggs from Washington state. Now scientists are trying to figure out how the bird flu fared in Alaska over the winter.
People have understood that avian influenza viruses can remain viable or infectious in cold water for long periods of time for many years now.
Andy Ramey is a research geneticist with the USGS Alaska Science Center. He's also the director of the Molecular Ecology Laboratory.
In Minnesota and Alaska, in our initial experiments, we found that viruses seem to remain infectious for more than 7 months.
In those experiments, birds were exposed to infected water samples that were kept cold in a lab. Scientists also tested the virus in the field to find out more about the effects of cold winter temperatures.
in another experiment conducted only in Alaska, we left some of these vials in wetlands for more than a year. And a year later, some small proportion of the viruses were still viable.
Federal data shows a total of 232 recorded cases among wild birds in Alaska since last April. So far this spring, at least one wild bird on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta was found dead from the virus. Hunters who've been out along Alaska's west coast and further inland on the Delta this season say they haven't seen anything out of the ordinary. In recent months, the USDA has reported fewer avian influenza infections among wild birds across North America compared to the same time period last year. Andy Ramey says that could be tied to an increase in immunity among wild birds. But he says vigilance is key and that anyone who notices a sick or dead wild bird should still report it.
We're in some uncharted water here. As you know, historically, this didn't happen. We didn't have highly pathogenic viruses in wild birds. So our experience in this scenario is pretty limited.
According to Ramey, scientists started looking for avian influenza in North America in the 1990s. But it didn't show up on the continent until 2014. For 2 years, the virus persisted. It appeared again in 2021.
Since late 2021, we've had roughly 3,000 detections in wild birds in the United States. So this is like nothing we've ever seen. And now in this current outbreak, we're seeing many wild birds die on account of highly pathogenic avian influenza infection.
Ramey likens the outbreak among wild birds to the wildlife equivalent of the coronavirus pandemic humans have endured for the last 3 years. In Bethel, I'm Emily Schwing.
Prosecutors say an Anchorage man was impaired by marijuana when he killed his passenger in a car crash on the Seward Highway last summer. 47-year-old Lester Wild Jr. is charged with manslaughter and impaired driving in the August 8th crash near Turnagain Pass. The wreck left 46-year-old Jeffrey Andrews dead and several other people injured. According to charges in the case, Alaska State Troopers found Wild's sedan broken in two after it crossed the center line and struck a motorhome head-on. The sedan's speedometer was stuck at 110 miles per hour. Wild admitted to sharing a THC vape with Andrews but blamed wet, rutted roads for the crash. Prosecutors say Wild's blood tested positive for two separate THC compounds. Wild was arrested last month in a separate case from Clam Gulch, where prosecutors say he drove drunk and bit off part of his nephew's finger during a fight. Two people remain missing after a charter boat capsized near Sitka over Memorial Day weekend. The 30-foot aluminum boat was returned to Sitka by a salvage crew yesterday. The search began on the evening of May 28th after Kingfisher Charters notified the Coast Guard that one of their boats was overdue. The body of 57-year-old Maury Akawili was recovered from the scene on May 28th near the vessel that was partially capsized offshore of Low Island. His wife, 53-year-old Danielle Akawili, and her sister, 56-year-old Brandy Chow, were recovered from the boat on May 31st. The fourth passenger, 61-year-old Robert Sulis, and the boat's captain, 32-year-old Morgan Robidoux, still have not been found. Conditions on the water made accessing and recovering the partially submerged boat challenging. Salvage crews refloated and returned the vessel back to Sitka yesterday. A press release from the Alaska State Troopers says search efforts moving forward will occur only if new clues or information are reported to law enforcement. Renewed search efforts would be evaluated at that time. The Coast Guard continues to investigate the circumstances surrounding the accident. Another Alaska-based wildfire crew is headed to Canada. Alaska Fire Service spokesperson Beth Ipson says the Midnight Sun Hotshot crew left Sunday for the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho.
Where they will get their gear together and their vehicles and drive up to Edmonton, Alberta.
The group follows the Alaska Division of Forestry Pioneer Peak Hotshots, who deployed to Alberta last month. Ipson says lower 48 crews are also helping out in Canada, where an unprecedented early wildfire season continues.
There have been more than 2,000 wildfires that have burned 9.3 million acres across Canada.
Fires are currently active from British Columbia on the west coast to Nova Scotia on the east coast. Meanwhile, Ipson says the Alaska and lower 48 fire seasons are off to a slower start.
Nationally, the number of acres burned is below the 10-year average.
Ibsen says Alaska had only one staffed fire as of yesterday.
10-acre fire that's on the Yukon River, about 4 miles west of Stephen Village, that smoke jumpers think that they're going to have wrapped up in a couple of days and demobilized.
Ibsen says Alaska still has crews and aircraft ready if the fire season here takes off. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Zoo fosters baby moose calves and a bear cub.
These animals can be saved. They can be ambassadors for their species and do a lot of really good education and conservation work.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
The first Copper River salmon dip net opening has been delayed. The personal use fishery at Chitna was scheduled to open tomorrow, but area management biologist Mark Somerville says that's been pushed back until 12:01 a.m. Monday.
Mostly due to cold temperatures in the Copper River, ice out was really delayed.
Somerville says the late breakup delayed deployment of some sonar salmon counting equipment, and that slow commercial harvest on the Copper River Delta also indicates the salmon are running late.
Fish are scattered about offshore. They're not really orienting into shore and stuff, which indicates that the run is still on its way in.
Somerville emphasizes that fishery managers remain optimistic about this year's forecast of 53,000 Chinook and 1.6 million sockeye, both of which are better than last season and based on strong brood years for the returning fish. Well, a 9-year-old has won first prize and $10,000 in the Sitka Salmon Derby after landing a 32.5-pound king. Second and third place went to an 11- and 15-year-old, respectively. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, it's not necessarily beginner's luck that put these kids on top. Some of them have been in the Derby for years.
John McCrayan has been chairman of the Sitka Salmon Derby for 23 years. He says there were at least three former champions fishing this year whose combined ages may come in somewhere north of 240 years. This year, though, the top three places were claimed by anglers whose combined ages total 35 years. McCrayan is not bothered by this in the least.
Well, it's exciting. It gets them, no pun intended, it gets them hooked.
9-year-old Caleb Gray's 32.5-pound salmon held the lead all through fishing the second weekend of the Derby, and that's no fluke. Gray also is the total weight leader for the Derby, bringing in just under 209 pounds of king salmon over 5 days of fishing. McCrayan let Gray hold the horn that would signal the end of the Derby Sunday night. With 8 minutes to spare, a boat pulled into the Derby barge and landed a fish that was quite obviously smaller than Gray's 32-pounder. McCrayan nevertheless called out 47.5 just to see Gray's reaction.
And you should have seen the look on his face. He knew that that number was bigger than his, and he didn't know if he should cry or what. And then I looked over at his dad, Kenny, who was leaning against an ice chest, and his expression was about the same. So I got them both.
McCrayan is a big bear of a man, and playing with the kids in the Derby comes easily to him. But they have played him, too. 3 years ago, at the end of his 20th season, he was stopped in his big bear tracks by a child named Piper Vaughn.
I was going to announce at the ceremony that I was retiring, that it was time for new management to come in, and then Piper comes up with a picture that she had colored of her fish hanging on the scale and a thank you at the bottom with kisses, you know, and I can't do this.
Third place finisher Riley Bernhardt began her Derby career in a similar fashion to Caleb Gray, entering her first salmon as a 6-year-old, the Derby minimum. Now a teen, she is the second highest in total pounds landed at 185, and one of her kings was the third largest in the Derby at 29.5 pounds. Again, these numbers point to years of experience, not luck. McCrayan says Bernhardt knows her way around the leaderboard.
So I think she's now 16 or 17. And she was down there at the barge telling her dad, just calm down. I've got to, you know, she was holding her fish up and wanted pictures, and she wanted them a certain way. And he was griping about how long it was taking, and he just put them in his place. And they just, this is my time. You just wait.
Bernhardt will win a pot puller worth $2,000 for her third place king, as well as a variety of cash prizes for high weight and largest fish of the day. The second largest fish in the Derby was landed by 11-year-old Jack Haley at just under 32 pounds, and he'll claim $5,000 in prize money. Haley also brought in the third most poundage, right behind Bernhardt at 162 total pounds. 11 is the perfect age to be distracted by the state Division I high school baseball tournament, which was held over the same weekend in Sitka. But McCrayan has first-person evidence to the contrary.
Mike White, who's been in the Derby for years, he was with Mike Svensson down at Goddard this year helping. And I guess he was asking all the kids down there, would they rather play baseball or go fishing? And after a couple minutes of thought, most of them said they'd rather be fishing.
McCrayan says he's unsure whether this year's large purse will continue into the future. Several generous families and businesses contributed to the increase in prize money, and the final numbers have yet to be crunched. In all, 490 fish were turned in by 155 people over the 5 days of fishing. Proceeds from the sale of the salmon benefit the Sitka Sportsmen's Association's scholarship fund, its educational programs, and Sitka High's state champion shooting league, the Shore Shots. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Many communities in Alaska do not have access to high-speed broadband internet, and in Bristol Bay, local partners are looking to change that by bringing a fiber-optic network to the region. As KDLG's Christina McDermott reports, the project is slowly making progress.
Almost all of Bristol Bay is unserved or underserved when it comes to broadband access. That's according to federally set standards. In Dillingham, the region's hub, city offices don't have enough internet to run certain software programs, and even if they did, they'd have to contend with a sometimes slow and spotty connection. Will Cheney is CEO of Nishigaak Cooperative, the local utility company. He says that reliable connection is especially important for rural Alaska.
Our physical separation really shines a light on the need for that durable broadband connection, if you will. And fiber is something that the cooperative recognizes is the gold standard for broadband delivery.
Since 2021, the Nishigaak Cooperative has been working to develop a fiber optic network for the region. Originally, it had planned to complete a route from Leavelock to Dillingham by this April, laying roughly 100 miles of cables. The co-op was working through a federal grant that required it to contribute money. But in 2021, legislature presented a new source of funding and shifted the project timeline. The cooperative now plans to finish laying cables by next year.
Where it took a turn was Chokyong Tribal, and Chokyong Limited realized that they had access to a higher level of funding that did not require a match. And they approached the cooperative with the offer initially.
Chokyong Limited and the Chokyong Tribe applied for a tribal broadband grant. Chokyong Limited's CFO, Braden Shifley, says they saw the opportunity for a mutually beneficial partnership.
What that meant was that essentially Nishigaak's members, of which a lot of them were also Chokyong shareholders, would be able to get the benefit of high-speed, reliable broadband internet without having, you know, a whole bunch of increases in cost to do that.
Shifley says it took nearly a year to secure the funding, and the grant was finalized last fall. This type of project impacts the environment. Similar projects in northern Alaska have affected permafrost levels. Cheney says the cooperative has worked with surrounding communities to complete environmental surveys and obtain building permits. The proposed route and easements are open to public comment until mid-June. Leavelock Natives Limited is a local partner for the project. In a written statement, General Manager Tiara Turner said the initiative, quote, opens up further opportunities to advance education, expansion, and infrastructure. Our corporation values local partnerships like Nishigaak and are excited about the improvements and benefits this project will generate, for our shareholders and residents living in rural Alaska. Once the network has been established, the cables will link to GCI's proposed IHUC network. Nishigaak's internet rates are currently more than twice the national average. Cheney, the cooperative's CEO, says they expect the fiber network to reduce maintenance costs. But Cheney says rates will remain the same, at least initially.
As the broadband from our fiber network is developed and put to use, as it matures, we hope to see a savings in cost of operation, and that could lead to decreased prices.
The cooperative faces competition from SpaceX's Starlink satellite internet. Dozens of its accounts have closed in recent months. Starlink offers unlimited internet through low-flying satellites at about half the price of Nishigaak. The company charges a $600 one-time fee, and customer installation and repair services are remote. As for the city of Dillingham, it plans to add a Starlink dish to make use of both internet providers, a more stable option, at least for now. In Dillingham, I'm Christina McDermott.
The public can comment on the project through June 23rd on the state's website.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience. Your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Rapid changes in Arctic temperatures are influencing animal reproductive behavior. A University of Alaska Fairbanks scientist published a study in the current edition of Science magazine building on 25 years of measurements. KUAC's Robin reports.
Researchers around the world know Dr. Brian Barnes as the squirrel guy. That's because he and his colleagues rocked the scientific world in the late 1980s with the discovery of a mammal that can lower its body temperature below freezing and survive, the Arctic ground squirrel.
We call them siksiks, which is onomatopoetic for their warning call, which is chick chick, and similar to the Inupiaq name for Arctic ground squirrels, which is siksik.
That discovery is still influencing cryogenic research and stroke medicine. Over the years, researchers affiliated with University of Alaska Fairbanks have collected data on 199 living Arctic ground squirrels, sometimes in the lab or outdoor enclosures behind the science buildings on campus, but mostly at Tulik Lake Research Station in the Brooks Range, where the squirrels are in their natural Arctic habitat.
It wasn't until recent years that we've been able to look back, and while there have been no significant changes in annual air temperature, the soil temperatures in the winter have become warmer. And what's important for this paper, we've detected a response by the animals to it.
Barnes authored this latest study along with former UAF students who are now researchers and professors at Colorado State University, Northern Arizona University, and the Rocky Mountain Research Station. It looks at how warmer soil temperature is affecting Arctic ground squirrel reproduction. There's something more you need to know about this animal besides the spectacular low hibernation temperature. Male squirrels emerge from hibernation in March, giving them about a month to ramp up their fertility to be ready for mating when females come out of their burrows about a month later. And that time on the calendar seems to be hardwired in the males. It's not changed over the 25 years of the study. But the scientists have tracked an entirely different calendar for the females.
And it's that we have seen shifting over the 25 years of our study, that the average date that these females are electing to come above ground and start off their active season has now occurring 10 days earlier than it was when we first began to record all of this in the early 90s.
And that's throwing off the squirrel's reproductive schedule.
That these females are coming up earlier and earlier, but the males aren't because they have this hardwired clock that says don't come up until the right time is leading to gender mismatch.
That gender mismatch means the squirrels could miss the opportunity to mate. Barnes says temperatures measured in the soil later above the permafrost freezes later in the fall, doesn't get as cold in the middle of winter, and thaws slightly earlier in the spring. The scientists suspect the females are influenced by the warmer soils.
A 10-day difference in coming early is a big piece of that. So we're wondering what's going to happen. If females continue in this way and come up earlier and earlier and males don't respond, females are just going to be hanging out with no mates available. And that's where this could go wrong for the Arctic ground squirrel.
If they hang around too long, they have a greater risk of being eaten.
Because they would be more subject to predation by the golden eagles and the foxes and the wolves that are very much looking for that first squirrel that's coming up.
Barnes and his colleagues' latest research is published in the current edition of Science magazine. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
One brown bear cub and six moose calves are settling into life at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage, and the zoo is nearly at capacity for housing orphaned animals. In late May, the zoo welcomed a very talkative brown bear cub nicknamed Gator from Hood Bay near Angoon. The six moose calves followed soon after, each nicknamed after Australian wildlife: kangaroo, mouse, wombat, echidna, emu, and wallaby. Executive Director Patrick Lampe says it's been a lot of work.
From this time on, up through July, is when we're usually busiest in receiving orphaned animals.
Lampe says the number of orphans the zoo can foster is decided by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and depends on how many permanent homes are available that year. The zoo doesn't keep the orphans they take in. Their focus is on rehabilitating the animals, which often arrive emaciated or in poor health. Once they're healthy, the zoo works with Fish and Game to place them, usually at zoos in the lower 48. Lampe says they've sent orphans to zoos all across the United States.
It's not the ideal situation because they're not in the wild, but these animals can be saved. They can be ambassadors for their species and do a lot of really good education and conservation work.
But transporting animals can be tricky. They're usually sent on cargo flights with multiple attendants. They need permits, medical records, and health certificates. In the meantime, the orphans are on public view at the Alaska Zoo. Gator the bear in the orphaned cub facility and the moose calves right next door in their infirmary yard. In the wild, Lampe says it's important not to assume a young animal is orphaned just because it's alone. Many species will leave their babies to go foraging.
It's best not to interfere. You contact somebody with Fish and Game and let them know where it is, and then let them make sure it's really an orphan and that out of the goodness of your heart, you're not creating the orphan yourself.
The zoo also took in an orphaned polar bear cub named Kova in November, who was found living under a building by a dumpster in Prudhoe Bay. She was placed under rabies quarantine protocols for 6 months, which ended May 30th. Kova made her first public appearance at the zoo on Sunday night. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Bethel, Chris Clint and Dev Hardiker in Anchorage, Catherine Rose and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross and Robin in Fairbanks, and Christina McDermott in Dillingham. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.